This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. R. Kelly is one of the big names in R&B. 51-year-old artist has sold more than 60 million albums, won multiple awards for hits like I Believe I Can Fly. But throughout his decades-long career, he's also earned a reputation as a serial abuser. A lawsuit filed Monday accuses him of sexual battery and failure to disclose an STD. And that's just the latest in a string of allegations that detail an array of misconduct. Entertainment industry leaders like Shonda Rhimes and Ava DuVernay have renewed the effort to mute R. Kelly and demand that companies who profit from his music cut ties. One of the many topics we'll talk about on this installment of Back Channel, our recurring series connecting culture and context. Later, we'll break down Childish Gambino's smash hit video, This Is America. We'll hear music from Janelle Monáe's new album and talk with professor and producer Yaba Blay about her series. Joining me for all that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a filmmaker and adjunct professor. Welcome back, Natalie. Good
Thank
to have
you
here.
Good to be here.
Mark is the chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
How you doing, Frank?
Well, let's start with a clip that details the latest allegations from R. Kelly, about R. Kelly. This is 20-year-old Faith Rogers filed a lawsuit Monday accusing R. Kelly, R&B artist, as we said, of false imprisonment, sexual battery, and failure to disclose a sexually transmitted disease.
Did you want to have sex with him?
No. He has this type of, like, intimidation right off the bat, you know? So I was just waiting for it to be over.
What happens after that? What sort of conversation did you guys have?
He comes over and he starts, like, rubbing the side of my face. And he asked me how old I was. And I told him. And he's like, you know, if you're really, you know, 16, that you can tell daddy, right? And he was like, you know, you just look about 14, 15, or 16. He goes on to tell me that he raises 5 women. Some of them have been with him for 15 years, and he basically was trying to make it seem like it was a family thing. He described these women as being his family.
What was it about him that kept you going back?
It's not like all the time he was just, you know, this devious person. There's been times where he's, you know, crying, and he's telling me, you know, about his children, about his ex-wife, comparing himself to Michael Jackson and how, you know, how the media destroyed him, and he felt like that's what was going on in his life.
Why file the lawsuit?
I want it for girls like me who are gonna run into him in the future, and he's gonna do the exact same thing, but it could get worse, you know? I chose to walk away. What about the ones who don't walk away?
Now, that's 20-year-old Faith Rogers talking to CBS News correspondent Jerrica Duncan about her relationship with R&B singer R. Kelly. Rogers filed a lawsuit against R. Kelly Monday, accusing him of sexual battery and knowingly infecting her with herpes. I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. Natalie, and this is not new, so remind us of R. Kelly's history. It goes back decades.
Well, I mean, R. Kelly is from Chicago, my hometown, and I've been hearing about R. Kelly since I was in high school. He used to do talent shows at Kenwood High School, where he went, and I had a lot of friends there. So I remember seeing him in a talent show when I was like 15 years old. You know, and his rise to stardom really was exciting for a lot of us who had seen him come up, you know, through the ranks in Chicago. But that when he married Aaliyah, and I don't remember the year, I think it was 85, 86.
95, 96.
You know, that was shocking. And she was 15.
Right.
You know, and it seemed to be completely normal, you know, and at that time, certainly I was like, oh, okay, I guess, you know, if her parents are okay with that, I guess it's okay. But, you know, it just kept going from there. There continued to be these rumors of escapades that R. Kelly was having with underage girls, and nothing ever seemed to really come of it. He would be taken to court, there would be a settlement, or it would go away. But there was never really a reckoning. And he continued to, you know, become more and more popular, sell more and more albums. And it almost seemed like the infamy of what he was rumored to be doing fed and fueled his popularity. So it's really been interesting and also, I have to say, sort of satisfying to see that there's finally this groundswell of people who are saying enough is enough, you know.
Well, it's interesting, too, because it was, in fact, July of 94 when he gets married, all right? But again, these rumors had been circulating for a long time. It wasn't until 2008 that he was finally tried, Mark, on a, and ultimately acquitted.
Yeah,
right?
For a video that by that time was almost 5 or 6 years old. And the jury didn't want to believe the age. They thought that the young girl looked too old, that she couldn't have possibly been as young as she obviously was. And that's a whole other conversation about how black girls and black girls' bodies are read by the larger public.
Yeah.
That makes it very difficult sometimes to be able to prosecute these kinds of cases around sexual violence when it involves young black girls. The thing that is so fascinating on some level about R. Kelly is that we are talking about a 20-year trajectory. The first stories that Jim DeRogatis starts to write about R. Kelly in 1998 and 2000. You have a trial in 2008. Aaron Magruder takes him and us to task in his animated series a decade ago when Pitchfork chooses R. Kelly to be the headliner in 2013. Jim DeRogatis goes at it again. Pitchfork just apologized for a decision they made 5 years ago. The fact that he's remained untouched, I think, says so much more about how we view the lives of black women and girls than it does about R. Kelly.
Well, talk more about that, Natalie, about this vision, this cultural view of black women's bodies and
well,
how it plays in.
One thing I want to say is that, you know, this Mute R. Kelly movement really came from black women's organizations who've been doing work around black women's bodies and, you know, lobbying for rights for black women. For example, non-shackling of black women, in prison. So I'm talking about Sister Song. I'm talking about North Carolina Women's Blueprint or the Black Women's Blueprint and other organizations that are national who, you know, have actually been kind of at this, pecking at this for a while. So it really was, I think, Ava DuVernay and Shonda Rhimes, like, you know, certainly endorsed those efforts. But it's really been black women on the ground who've been doing this work for a long time. You know, there are all kinds of stereotypes and real tired tropes that exist that come from slavery that, you know, basically say that black women are hypersexual, that, you know, that we are responsible for our own victimization, that assault is, you know, we ask for it. And so what Mark was talking about when he spoke of, you know, juries not believing that the girl in the infamous video that R. Kelly is in, where he does some really disgusting things to an underage girl, you know, it is all about people not believing that black girls are actually girls, number one, but also that black women's bodies somehow are, you know, okay as sites of sexual violence. Like that is, it's okay. That's normal. Right. And that is part of what has to be shifted, that narrative that black women's bodies are somehow available for this type of sexual assault is something that we really have to address.
R. Kelly's story also feeds into what is, I'll call an aspirational blind spot amongst black America when folks rise to a certain kind of level, right? You know, so R. Kelly gets read along with Bill Cosby and some of these other folks as his, you know, famous and powerful and wealthy black figure who's being taken down, right? So folks are much more reticent to really do the kind of work that needs to be done to hold someone like R. Kelly accountable. Again, outside of this particular Me Too moment, I'm not sure this gets the kind of traction publicly that it has.
Right.
Because these women organizations have been doing this work for a long time. Yeah. It only gets any traction in the media because of this Me Too moment. And the thing that DeRogatis has talked about for a long time, if R. Kelly had sexually assaulted or kept enslaved one white woman, this narrative would be absolutely different. right? R. Kelly would not have, he's in some ways been much more successful since that video surfaced in 2002 than he was prior to that point. How do you explain that? The fact that someone like Tom Joyner in 2018 decides, I'm not going to play R. Kelly's music anymore, and didn't say that a decade ago.
Right.
Is it a ratchet effect? That is the Me Too movement, or is it only a moment? A ratchet effect in that it will stay at this point and not backslide? I mean, I'm taking a look. You know, you talked about Tom Joyner. There have been other venues that have canceled his events, but not Greensboro. In Greensboro, they went ahead with it, right? And so is it, you know, how long lasting?
Because they need the bodies in the seats, right?
Well, you know, I mean, everybody does, right, but you have to take a hit if you're going to actually say, look, we're gonna have to send a message here, right?
But, you know, I think that there's cultural complicity in how R. Kelly has been supported. And Black people, unfortunately, and I guess people in general, they really don't want to let go of what they love about R. Kelly's music.
Right.
Folks love the step in the name of love at picnics and barbecues. They don't want to give that up. And so until we can, like, make that sacrifice.
People want to believe they can fly.
Right.
I mean,
they want all of that. Right. Exactly.
Talking to popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on this edition of Back Channel. When we come back, Joe Van Gogh and Duke University. We'll talk about rap music, Black bodies in public spaces, all of that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Back Channel today, our recurring series connecting culture and context with popular culture experts Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. I want to talk about Duke University. Two employees at the Joe Van Gogh coffee shop on Duke University's campus terminated after the school's vice principal of student affairs, vice president, I think, of student affairs, Larry Mineta, complained about a rap song, Get Paid, by Young Dolph. It was playing in the establishment. Let's hear a clip now from Brittany Brown, who is one of the baristas, who was fired.
It was actually a playlist. Like, you know how you go on, like, Spotify, and, like, you pick a playlist, and you keep it moving?
Yeah.
Like, that's honestly what it was. It was not, like, a playlist. I was like, let's see what kind of crazy songs I can put on here. Like, this was, like, an honest mistake that just happened to pop up on a playlist. They pretty much said that Duke wanted them to terminate us, and that there was nothing that they can do, and that their hands were tied.
All right, that's Brittany Brown, one of the baristas who was fired earlier this month at Joe Van Gogh Coffee Shop at Duke University's campus, playing the song Get Paid, Young Dolph. That was inside the shop. The vice president for student affairs was there, Larry Mineta. He had a conversation that ended in their termination. Mark, what do you make of all this? By the way, Joe Van Gogh has since severed its ties with Duke, we should say.
Yeah, which is kind of the more humorous aspect of the story. Joe Van Gogh is like, Duke is messing up our brand. Right. Instead of the other way around. You know, Young Dolph is an artist I don't listen to. I had never heard the song. Once I listened to the song, I couldn't listen to it again.
Right.
So in some ways, I understand, given Larry's 60-something-year-old ears, I can understand what he heard. If it's me, I simply ask them to move on to the next song and move it on from there. The problem with this conversation is that ultimately, you know, when you hear songs like this and you question about whether or not they're offensive or not, you know, that's always dictated by the community. It's a difference if we're talking about a Joe Van Gogh that's over in West End, right? And anybody can go there. This is a Joe Van Gogh on campus. The student population is 18 to 25-year-olds. None of them are reacting to this music because it's just the background music, right? It's millennial music to them. And so we have to take that into account. The level of hubris that Vice President Mineta showed, right, to not let this go, and specifically 3 weeks after he very publicly supported the idea of free speech in the face of hate speech that was being directed by students of color and others, it struck a real strong chord in terms of the contradictions there, right? Mm-hmm. So you're going to allow, you want to have conversation where there's hate speech on campus, but when you hear a rap song that you don't like, that you find offensive, you want to have the folks who play the music fired. And that's the contradiction that I think that folks caught up on.
Yeah. Right? And I think it's also, you know, incredibly patronizing for even though he's a VP of Student Affairs, for him to decide that this is not appropriate music for a coffee shop, you know, on a college campus. As Mark said, these are 18 to 25-year-olds who are frequenting the coffee shop, and they have no problem with it. So it's, you know, it's there's a fine line between I think school officials and I know that this happens on other campuses. It's not unique to Duke, but there's a real fine line between, you know, sort of making sure that what is made available and provided for students is appropriate, and then like dictating what, you know, based on your personal choices, right, and actual biases.
Let me suggest this, though, just for a moment, and think about all the cross currents, the cultural cross currents in this particular moment, because you have, let's suppose you're the vice president for student affairs of a major university like Duke, and you hear the lyrics of that song, which are decidedly sexist and racist, although if I like this music, I should be able to choose for myself. I get that. But I hear that, and I'm sitting there, and I'm imagining now the Instagram moment where my picture is going up on Instagram approving of this racist, sexist language in the Me Too Black Lives Matter moment. And I'm tuned to that signal and say, I don't want my picture. I don't want to be seen here approving of this language. So I'm going to make a statement that this kind of thing doesn't stand on our campus.
And I'm clear Larry probably processed it that way. But this is also the same person who oversees the campus's annual last day of classes concert, in which they've booked folks like Travis Porter, which are far more profane than even Young Dolph, right? So it's not as if, like, he hasn't approved a moments of that has occurred, right? If he was totally against it, then there would be much more policing, for instance, of some of the activities around LDOC, you know, where students are basically, you know, in a drunken stupor for a day, right, on what is actually the last day of classes. So very often you have professors who have to change what they're doing in the classroom because of the drunken stupor that the students are in for the day, right, to go listen to some wild, profane music, you know, that evening. And I'm all for students releasing energy and what have you, but let's have some consistency here. And it's that kind of consistency, because the way the story, you know, then circulates is that, you know, Duke hates hip hop. And this is less than a month after Kendrick Lamar wins a Pulitzer Prize.
Right.
And let's be honest, you know, Damn is just as profane as anything that you hear with Young Dolph. So had he walked into that coffee shop and heard something from, you know, from Kendrick Lamar and reacted the same way, it would have been far worse.
And the other cultural cross current and headline was the Philadelphia Starbucks, which if you were tuned to that, you might also have felt that in a different way. So how you're tuning your ears and what you're tuning yourself to becomes a question. I want to move on. I want to talk about Childish Gambino's song and video, This Is America. It's on Billboard's Top 100 chart, number one for the second week in a row. Millions of hits going viral, the video itself, on the internet. I want to play a clip from This Is America. Let's listen.
This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping up. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Look how I'm living now. Police be tripping now. Yeah, this is America. Guns in
my area.
I got the strap.
Hey.
I gotta carry 'em. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go into this. Yeah, yeah, this is gorilla. Yeah, yeah, I'ma go get the bag. Yeah, yeah, or I'ma get the pad. Yeah, I'm so cold.
All right, that's a bit of Donald Glover's latest Childish Gambino release. This is America. The track leads Billboard's Hot 100 chart for the second week in a row, and one of the few times in the world that I really wish I was in television, because you really need to see this video.
Yeah, you do.
Natalie,
tell us
about it. Yeah,
I mean, it is. It's almost like a dream. It's like a dreamscape, you know, where there are so many different things going on. And this running thread seems to be embodied in Childish Gambino, in the horrible acts that he commits. And I won't spoil it for people who haven't seen the video, but then also in the just exuberance of the dancing that he participates in and that he leads. And so there's a really stark contrast between, you know, the violence of the video and what I dare say called black joy that is on display. You know, and of course, he is making a statement about, I think, just the absurdity of this particular moment, how, you know, and what it means to be black in this America, when police, yes, are are brutalizing Black people, and still Black people find a way to have joy, to find those moments where they can revel in Blackness, in being Black. But always there's this danger that is lurking, right, you know, around the corner.
Well, gun violence. I mean, I think we should spoil that part of it, Mark, and say that that is central to this. And yeah, the entertainment gloss that sometimes gets between the protest and the violence, right?
So I'm going to be the curmudgeon that I've accused Stanley Crouch and Ishmael Reed of being for the last 30 years, because I'm much more ambivalent about the project. Not so much the content of it, but the reception of it. Mm-hmm. When Newsweek and Time Magazine and other these elements are covering with the kind of specificity that they have a piece of Black cultural production, it always makes me wonder what kind of labor that cultural production is actually doing. Mm. The fact that this gets now attached to Childish Gambino, Donald Glover, in a certain kind of way, as if Hiro Murai, you know, who directed the video and who has shot 70% of Atlanta, and who, in my estimation, did a far more brilliant and provocative video with Flying Lotus and Kendrick Lamar, you know, 5 years ago that no one has seen, right? Mm-hmm. Because of the kind of way and where Childish Gambino fits, you know, in the ecosystem. My response to it was that many of the young folks who were responding to the video needed to spend more time in the archive. Mm. So, for instance, when I hear those recurring lines, "This is America," my head immediately went to Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. And the last 5 minutes of the film, you know, you in fact have, you know, the director and the main character repeating over and over again, "This is America," which I'm sure Hiro knew, right? And was part of the packaging of the product. You know, I think Black art is so much more complicated to take this one piece of Black art and throw it up on a pedestal, not realizing that it's connected to all of these other things.
Yeah, but Mark, I'll take it. For instance, the Washington Post did this kind of frame-by-frame analysis, practically, in which it showed some of the moves that some of the dance moves, and then flashed up Jim Crow posters. So, I mean, they're doing
the Confederate, right? Yeah, right.
Yeah. So, I mean, some of that's happening as a result of this thing, and maybe it's just because of the wild popularity.
I raise this question, and you can answer this, you know, Natalie. Do you think we're still talking about this video 3 months from now?
I mean, that's a good question. Probably not. Probably not.
Well, that was one of the themes in the video, right? Yeah. Is how quickly we get
right.
Over.
I mean, right.
It's
leading, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about Janelle Monáe for a minute, because let's talk about her new album, Dirty Computer, first solo album in 5 years. Many are saying it's the first time she is unapologetically herself. Now, let's just listen to Janelle talking about the album itself, called Dirty Computer, and here's some thoughts she had about the composition of this album.
I think that this album deals with what it means to come from the dirt. Like, we come from the dirt. When we go on to another frequency, in my opinion, our physical selves will go back to the dirt. I also had this dream, this whole thought when I was making the project about how we are computers, how our brains are CPUs, how we're uploading, we're downloading, we're processing, we're transmitting information. And some of us are told that the way we were created hold these bugs and these viruses, these things that make us unique, whether it's our sexuality, whether it's because we're Black, whether it's because we're a woman, whether it's because we're poor. You know, I'm just naming a few of these marginalized groups. But some people say that those are bugs, those are viruses. And Dirty Computers say, no, those are our attributes, those are features. You know, this helps make the world better.
Janelle Monáe talking with Annie Mack on BBC Radio 1 about the new album, Dirty Computer. I'm here with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. What do you make of this, Natalie, the album?
Well, you know what? I was not a Janelle Monáe fan, really, up until this album. I've listened to the album probably 5 times. And the more I listen to it, the more it grows on me. And the more, I think what you started talking about, when you introed the Janelle Monáe clip, and the fact that people are saying that this is the first time she's unapologetically herself, I think that's what draws me to the project. I think it's heavily influenced by Prince. I mean, there are songs that I feel like I'm trying to like match it with, you know, an old 90s Prince song, because it just reminds me so much of that spirit and energy. But there are I mean, there are quite a few. I would say half the album really seems to be Janelle Monáe uniquely herself and really putting, you know, herself on the line, like artistically, in a way that I haven't experienced her before. And so I feel like, you know, now she is, I'm seeing who she really is, and I like it. And, you know, it's appealing to me in ways that I did not expect.
Let's hear a little bit of the music. This is the song Pink from that album.
Pink like the inside of your baby. Pink behind all of the doors. Crazy pink like the tongue that goes down. Maybe pink like the paradise found. Pink when you're blushing inside. Baby, pink is the truth you can't hide. Maybe pink like the folds of your brain. Crazy pink.
Pink by Janelle Monáe, her new album, Dirty Computer. I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, what about this? Out from under the shadow of Prince and yet still influenced by Prince.
I think folks have always been concerned with Janelle Monáe that while we understood the brand and we really connected in some ways to the Cindy Mayweather android character, we weren't sure how much was there actually musically, right? You know, when you think about some of her earlier music, we think about the impact of like Big Boy on that very first project that came out and things like that. So I think we're starting to hear her mature musically in ways that we hadn't heard in her previous music. I think the fact that she also now is recognized as just Janelle Monáe because of the cinematic roles that she's taken on.
And just let me stop you there, because she had really produced records under that persona before.
Right.
She talked about being almost fearful coming out.
Right, coming out and being Janelle Monáe, right? Because it was always Sydney Mayweather, right? And we were reading her through that. But when you think about her role in Hidden Figures and Moonlight and things like that, it literally humanized Cindy, if you will, so that we could find Janelle.
Yeah.
And so when we hear some of these tracks and we're dealing with issues of desire and intimacy, stuff that we didn't normally attach to Janelle Monáe's character in the ways that she, you could almost argue that she has sexualized herself, not in any dirty, funky kind of way, but to made herself a sexual being in ways that we hadn't seen her before, I think brings folks to the music in a way that we hadn't heard it before.
And does she bring issues to the fore as well? I mean, is it a blow for feminism, this song Pink, when you see the video that goes along with it? Or is this just pop culture production?
No.
Is there more to it than
I think that? I think that Pink is brilliant. I think that it absolutely is a feminist statement. And I think more importantly that Janelle is making space for Black women's sexuality across the spectrum, whether you're queer or you're heterosexual.
Trans, absolutely.
And I think that that's so important, especially, you know, in light of what we've been talking about in terms of, you know, the hypersexualization of Black women and girls, you know, vis-a-vis R. Kelly. For someone like Janelle Monáe to basically present, you know, the heart, if you will, of what it means to be a woman, of regardless of your orientation, I think that that's really important, and I think she does it in a way that is not poppy. I think it's not, you know, it could have fallen flat, you know, actually, but I think that she is. She is a great musician, I think. And I do agree with Mark that we are seeing her mature musically. And I feel like Pink is almost like the culmination of a whole bunch of things coming together for her in one song.
I wonder, too, if this means, and we're going to talk to Yaba Blay about just this thing in just a few minutes, but if this means we're breaking out of these two, sort of these two polar orbits that we had been in when it comes to Black women's bodies, hypersexualized or somehow utterly muted in order to make it in the mainstream and being told that this is kind of, if you're going to make it, walk away from that image. And now we're seeing a moment where being who you are in all of your fullness is not hypersexualized.
We see some of that in Janelle. We see that in a pregnant Cardi B.
Yeah, right.
We see this in Rihanna and the fact that she gives no damns about her body, right, and how folks perceive it, right? This is my body. I'm comfortable with it, whether or not I'm a size 16 or a size 10.
And gets millions of hits on Instagram, no matter what she is wearing. I mean, people love Rihanna because of that, I think.
Right, absolutely.
Well, we're going to talk more about that. I've got about 30 seconds here. I want to maybe just briefly talk about the ABC sitcom Black-ish, which has moved into, again, a sort of a more normalized plot series, right, about a divorce, about a normal divorce in a Black family. How important is this divorce sequence in the sitcom Black-ish, Mark?
It was interesting watching people on social media because it felt as though they were blowing up the Black sitcom. And the way that we think about the Black sitcom and how the lines, particularly for these married couples, right? Because in some ways, Black-ish is the extension of the Cosby Show, right? In some ways, they had to pursue this storyline not only to distance itself to what the Cosby Show was to folks in the 1980s, but also to speak to the reality of who Bill Cosby is in the world now in relationship to that show. It is never neat and pretty and perfect little lines, but there's always these complicated backstories, and we got some element of that in this particular storyline in Black-ish.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the fact that that we're even seeing this sort of storyline in Black-ish also just helps to dispel some of the myths and stereotypes around Black love, Black relationships, and it's so un-Cosby-ish that it's refreshing.
Natalie Bullock-Brown, Mark Anthony Neal, back channel on The State of Things. Just ahead, what does it mean to be a professional Black girl? Yaba Blade joins us. She created the video series, and we'll talk more about that on The State of Things in a moment. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. What does it mean to be a professional Black girl? According to Yaba Blay, it has nothing to do with a PhD or a high-powered job. It's about fully embracing Black girl culture. And that's what she does in the short-form video series, Professional Black Girl.
In our online celebrations of hashtag Black Girl Magic, I was feeling like we were leaving out the Keishas and the Nae-Nae's. While we're out here celebrating the Michelle Obamas and the Serena Williams of the world, we were forgetting just who they were before they became who they are. Michelle's feathered hair in that Huey Newton chair, Black. Serena Williams' braids with the entire pack of beads, Black. And they were consciously repping for Black girls, consciously repping for us.
Yaba Blade, Dan Blue Endowed Chair in Political Science at North Carolina Central University, the creator of Professional Black Girl. It's a video series that profiles women who unapologetically embody Black girl culture. Second season comes out this fall, and she joins us now to preview the program. Yaba Blade, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Now we can hear you talk without the backing track.
Yes.
Good. Well, welcome. It's good to still with me, popular culture experts, back channel contributors, Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So tell us more about the impetus behind this project.
Professional Black Girl is the project I never intended to do, but it is my most favorite thing of every single day. I was actually working on another video series in my mind, at least, one that was more focused on nuanced conversations about Black hair culture. And in my mind, I was just going to have like a quick ending segment called Professional Black Girl. I started using the hashtag because folks who follow me on social media know that I'm there to play. Right, for the most part. And Instagram is probably my favorite of them all. So sharing images, and folks would tag me in images and videos and sent, because they know I love little girls, especially clowning and being grown, whatever that means. And so I started using that hashtag as a way to kind of characterize the level to which they were being Black girls. And so to me, that was a professional level. And so I didn't have a rationale at the time, and now the more I started using it, the more other people started using it, and once I started doing the video series, I came to realize just how important it was to nuance the language around professional, particularly for Black women and Black girls. I see it a lot now working at an HBCU, where I know that a lot of my students are being encouraged by other Black women to act a particular way, to dress a particular way, to wear their hair in a particular way, to lose weight, to do all these things, because there's this notion that out there in the quote-unquote real world, you have to not be yourself. Right.
We were just talking about that dyad that we've had. There's two planets around which, you know, the whole conversation orbits, the hypersexualization of Black women, and then they'll run away from that so you can be a success in the real world.
Yeah, and it's not real. And I think the thing that I appreciate about this moment, and maybe social media is a part, has something to do with that, the fact that we are all so plugged in so much, so we see so much of the world now. What I recognize now is just so many other people don't really care about all these critical analysis that we have. They're living their lives, right? So you can call me hypersexual. You can tell me I have to act this way. And at the end of the day, I'm just going to beaming.
What were those conversations you were having? Because you said you wanted it to be initially about hair, so you were going into beauty salons and just talking to people, and you were hearing the conversations that changed your point of view on this. What were you hearing?
Not so much that it changed my point of view, but just recognizing that, like, I might want to talk about all these other things from a theoretical standpoint, from a cultural standpoint, and many of us just find joy in talking about which hair products we're going to use or, you know, what's on sale at the beauty supply store or look at this old product. I remember being in an aisle with one of my colleagues slash friends, Akiba Solomon, who's an editor and directs, manages colorlines.com. And we're in the aisle and I see pink oil moisturizer and I open up the bottle and like put it to her nose. She's like, oh, my God, that smell. Right. The smell will take you right back to the 80s. And so, like, I just recognize how, just on a very simple level, we were having fun. It was like a playground for grown black women in the beauty supply store. And it was very much connected to our own personal histories. And so I wanted to explore that.
I want to play a clip from the first season to give us a sense of what you were doing at season one, because you're about to launch season two. Let's play this.
A professional black girl is a girl who takes her blackness very seriously. It's an everyday performance. It's a way to not just shield yourself from white supremacy, but also claim belonging to a larger group. And so for me, it's not just the baby hairs or the ways that I dress, but also highlighting my body, which is, right, undeniably curvy, which is something that, you know, is an in-your-face kind of representation of my blackness. So I accentuate rather than hide that. And I think that's what being a professional black girl kind of arms me with. It's this pride in who I am, right? Sticking out. As a professional black girl, you don't really want to stand in. You don't really want to fall in line, right? You want to be seen.
Scholar and traveler Asia Leeds in an episode from Professional Black Girl Season 1, short-form web series created by my guest Yaba Blay, producer and professor of political science at North Carolina Central University. Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal here as well. Are we in a particular moment where you feel comfortable doing that, where we can all feel comfortable? Say, as you said, I'm a scholar and nobody wants to talk about that thing, but you as a scholar can appear in other on other platforms and say, let's have fun?
Absolutely. I think it's important. I think for myself, or someone like Asia, Dr. Treva Lindsay was also in the episode, Rhapsody. So many women who, again, you would call quote-unquote professional from your standard definitions, but what you see them as being real regular, right? And in that way, I think a lot of younger women, college-age women's little girl, and other everyday women can relate. So there's not that distance, right? Whatever you think about us aspirationally, recognize that we are just like you. What I really appreciate about Asia's perspective and using the language of protection and arming is that something as simple as laying your baby hair down with brown gel is armor in a world that has told you to look this way in order to be seen as professional, look like someone who is not yourself in order to be accepted. And it's like, no, I'm gonna do all the things that are so quintessentially recognizably black, and you're just gonna have to deal.
Right.
Well, and Natalie, what's your take on the series and the success? Wildly successful.
Well, I remember when Yaba was first thinking about it, and you know, I don't think I had any clue of what it would eventually like become. And I just love it because it's so clear, and I've said this on social media, that Yaba loves us. She loves black women and girls. And you know, and to have someone who is as brilliant as Yaba, like, focus her attention on bringing to light the fact that black women and girls are marvelous. Like, we are amazing beings. And part of what makes us amazing is that, like, culturally, we do things that nobody else does, and it's almost inherent. And you can be 3 years old and almost like, it's like, you know, you come out of the womb knowing how to be a professional black girl. And it's something that, like, we see every day. You know, I grew up with other black women, saw little girls doing the very things that we see on social media today. But it took Yaba to, like, curate all of this and really bring it to us in a way that really, you know, causes us to, like, you know, it's like she's loving on us. And I think that that's really important, especially in this era when there is so much that's saying, you know, we don't even see you. You are invisible to the rest of the world.
Mark?
First off, What's up to Professor Leeds? But the thing that I appreciate about Yava, it's about the independent spirit of all of her work. So, you know, she's done the CNN thing. And when publishers weren't quite feeling what her book was, she just published it herself. I'm sure she could have taken this project to PBS or CNN or any number of folks, but she chose to do it herself. Mm-hmm. You know, she hasn't told the story, but when she decided that she needed to crowdfund for season two, how quickly folks mm-hmm. contributed to that, because like Natalie said, folks know Yava loves us, right? Mm-hmm. This is something that I want to contribute to. And I think trusting someone who has that kind of spirit, who you know are going to tell stories that need to be told in the way that they need to be told, that's always going to love on us. It's important to support, to have that work out there, first of all, but also have the mechanism where we can continue to support and nurture that kind of work.
What were some of the, in season one, some of the conversations and some of the moments that really inspired you to move forward for season two now?
Again, I wasn't thinking about it. I was just doing it, you know, yeah. And then folks received it. And I think I became more clear, you know, with the Instagram. I just started the Instagram last year and up to 30,000 followers now. And like folks, like if there's a day that I don't post, I get DMs like, where are you? Have you seen this? Right. Can you post that? So I think I was inspired just by our freeness. It really did feel like, as much as it was a love letter from me to Black women and girls, the response is very much a love letter back to me. And so there was a year where there, you know, I was doing the Instagram, but I really wasn't thinking about another season because, again, as Mark said, doing it independently is not always easy, yep. right? I definitely burnt out after season one because I'm teaching. I'm also speaking. I was attempting to write and trying to create and having people expect and expect and expect. It's hard when you're just this lone ranger. And so I wasn't really thinking about it because I wasn't sure how it would be funded. And then folks were like, look, you can do this.
Do this and do this. And it's interesting, too, because what you hear over and over again is be myself. But you're talking about fashion, which is a performance, right? And so, but it's both that, and it's allowing, I guess, what I'm reading in this is that every selection, every choice you make about fashion is somehow reflective of who you are and whether or not you feel comfortable reflecting your own culture or having to.
Sure, absolutely. And I wouldn't say it's just about fashion. I think there's some sense of fashioning as well, right? Because I think generally speaking about the culture, but also speaking about the identity, right? So for example, Michelle Obama on Instagram 2 days ago posted a picture of herself from her first year, I believe, at Princeton. Right? Mm-hmm. And she had cornrows in her hair. Now, she wrote this very profound caption. Everybody's like, oh my God, look at Michelle. I zoom in on the picture and I'm like, Michelle has about 3 inches of new growth on those cornrows. And so, as a Black woman who attended both HBCUs and PWIs, I can tell you the narrative. Michelle went to Princeton from Chicago. She went to school, had her hair braided, and got to Princeton, and she wasn't going to trust just anybody to do her hair, not in Princeton, New Jersey.
She's going to wait till she goes back to Chicago
That's right. One break to get her hair done.
That's right.
There's a story just about that. And so that's the caption I put down. And folks are like, oh my God, of course. That's exactly what happened. So it's also about an identity. Right? Yeah. The way we do things, we know that you are loyal to your hairdresser, right? Or you at least look loyal enough to yourself to not let just anybody do your hair, right? So it's a way that we think about ourselves and think about things. Somebody else might say, well, just look it up online, look in the phone book, get somebody else to bring. You don't take those kind of chances. They have to come recommended, you know what I mean? So I think there's just so much of ourselves that we see in some very simple ways. And I think that's what's bringing joy to so many of us, is to say, you know, this is not just happenstance, right? That there's a part of us that lives in one another. And I think we're enjoying seeing that.
Yeah. I want to play a clip here from Tarana Burke, of course, founder of let's play this clip and we'll come back and talk about it.
It looks like me. It looks like you. It looks like Taraji at the awards jumping up to hug Viola Davis. You know, it looks like Mary and Taraji and Carrie in that Apple commercial. You know, it looks like me rolling up to a room full of people in Berlin to speak with my bamboo earrings on. You know, it looks like any number of ways that I celebrate my girls. It looks like me riding for my girls. You know, it looks like me always having my hair braided, right? It's a signature. It's always something that I'm going to have on me that's going to represent my Blackness, subtly or boldly.
but I'm always about it. I'm always thinking about it. You cannot not think about being black anyway. So since I have to think about it all the time, I think about it from that perspective.
Activist and founder of the Me Too movement, Tarana Burke, in an episode from Professional Black Girls Season 1. I'm here with producer and professor Yaba Blay from North Carolina Central University. Season 2 set in New Orleans. Tell us about that decision.
Yes, I was born and raised in New Orleans. So the thing about me and my work, I always center myself. I'm just...
It's always about you.
It's about me.
Mm-hmm. So when you heard Me Too, you misunderstood that.
No, but me thinking about, okay, if I'm such a professional black girl, the moment through which a lot of me being a professional black girl comes from two spaces, right? I'm first generation born here in the States. My family's from Ghana. So there's a lot of Ghana girl stuff that influences me culturally. But for the most part, I was raised and I think I was blackened in New Orleans, right? As I started thinking about what might it look like to do more seasons of Professional Black Girl, as opposed to just continuing having seasons where, you know, a group of women would come and tell their stories, thinking about, well, what if this became a traveling show? Because one of the pieces of feedback I got on YouTube, actually, was a woman who said, you know, I love this series, but it feels really Yankee. Like, this feels really northern. And I'm like, I shot this in Durham, North Carolina. But I recognized that they were all my girlfriends who were coming to visit me and see about me because I had just moved to Durham. So they're coming from northern spaces. And so, yes, you can hear their Brooklyn and their Bronx accents, right, on screen. So I'm like, you know what? That's interesting. I wonder what this might look like regionally. And so I just thought, well, maybe we'll just add a travel element to it and have future seasons focus on the particular brand of professional black girlism that comes out of cities. And so I started with my city.
Give us a preview. What are we going
to
hear?
Are you going to go to Jamaica one of these days?
Okay. Oh, I hope so.
Season 3 in Jamaica?
I hope so. I hope to go to Jamaica. I would love to go to Trinidad. I would love to see this all over the world.
Well, that would be it. I mean, the international take on this would be a fascinating.
Absolutely. Because that's another, like, right. What I also like about the kind of diaspora approach to this is, like, everywhere you go, there you are, right? And so if you recognize yourself culturally in your own space, you can see those connections in other spaces. But season 2, you know, almost done shooting, will soon be editing. I don't know what you're going to see. I interviewed a variety of folks. I interviewed a young girl, 21-year-old Queen Taj, who is the queen of the Wild Magnolias Mardi Gras Indians. So we talk about that cultural space. I interviewed Cheeky Black, who is well-known mother of twerk, you know, so which is interesting in a popular culture moment. We had Miley Cyrus out here, quote unquote, twerking. Everybody became interested in twerking, but nobody said Cheeky's name. And she is the first person who used that word, right? So speaking about her as a hip hop artist in that space, Chef Linda, who is known for a dish called yakamine. And again, most people come to New Orleans and you eat gumbo and you might have jambalaya, but nobody knows about yakamine. Mm-hmm. So giving you, you know, some insight into yet another kind of cultural space. And so the thing that'll be interesting and new about this season, whereas first season, they were all kind of talking head interviews in beauty salons. Next season, we get in Ubers and we explore the city. So I have each person take us to a different part of the city.
City of New Orleans. Yaba Blay, creator of the video series Professional Black Girls, second season comes out this fall. Also the Dan Blue Endowed Chair of Political Science at North Carolina Central. Natalie Bullock Brown, a film producer, an adjunct professor. Mark Anthony Neal, the chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Everything is at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.